From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The primary season is over, and oh, how we'll miss it. Not just for the dignity and substance evinced by the candidates, but also for the heroic conduct of the media, focused as they were single-mindedly on the pressing issues of the day.
Do you think Reverend Wright loves America as much as you do?
Campaign has some obstacles with revelations about $400 haircuts.
Senator Clinton, where are you on this? Red Sox or Yankees?
I noticed you put one on yesterday, but you've talked about this before, but it comes up again and again when we talk to voters. And as you may know, it is all over the internet.
Okay, maybe single-minded wasn't the right word. The reference from ABC's Charlie Gibson in the final debate between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama was to Obama's choice not to wear an American flag lapel pin. Economic crisis, global warming, oil prices, and war got discussed in the debates, but not to the exclusion of baseball loyalties, $400 haircuts, and lapel couture. In that Clinton-Obama debate, it wasn't clear who won, but it sure was apparent who lost.
We'll take one more commercial break. We'll come back. Say goodnight. Stay with us. Oh, you can. The crowd's turning on me. The crowd is turning on me. We'll be back in 1 minute.
As the general election presidential campaign gets unofficially but nonetheless contentiously underway, it appears that the booing isn't over. Presented with a proposal for a New York City debate hosted by Mayor Bloomberg and ABC News, both McCain's campaign and Obama's said no thank you. They both have expressed a desire to meet and discuss issues in a public forum, but not a forum mediated by the stars of TV news. Their thinking isn't entirely clear, but the signals are that both campaigns believe the network's preoccupation with incendiary side issues prevents the candidates from delivering their messages. Writing for the American Prospect, Associate Editor Ezra Klein welcomed a media unmediated candidate forum. Any argument that political journalists are needed to explore policy issues, he says, is unpersuasive.
I would dispute that actual journalists know a whole lot about policy. If we wanted to do debates where people got asked very tough questions, there would be a way to do it. We have these things called universities. DC is full of think tanks. There would really be ways to get actual experts onto a stage and have them interrogate the candidates. For campaign reporters, policy is not their job. Campaigns are, and so they ask about campaigns.
And you also suggested that there is an inherent conflict of interest because they're not just trying to get answers to their questions, but if they work for a network, sound bites for the next 11 broadcasts.
What the media can't have is a boring debate. That is death to them. And fair enough. But sometimes the sort of meat of politics is quite boring. I've been to these town halls. They're quite boring. Frankly, McCain and Obama can be quite boring. And part of the problem for the media, by the way, is that they're steeped in it already. So they've heard these answers on gas prices. They've heard the answers on healthcare. They're trying to get somewhere new. But people don't tune in till relatively late, and nobody tunes in all at once. So it actually is good for voters when a lot of this gets repeated. But it isn't sort of what I, as a reporter, am trained to do, which is push the story forward.
The gamble, I guess, that both campaigns are taking here is that the networks, having been pushed out of the center of the process, will still cover it. Is that a good bet?
It's a pretty good bet because, let's say, ABC and NBC and CBS decide not to, right? And Fox and CNN decide not to. What's going to happen that night is there going to be a whole lot of people watching MSNBC. Additionally, all the campaigns have stated that they want this covered, streamed, live on YouTube, whatever it may be. It makes it much easier for the campaigns to exert leverage over the process because the essential scarcity is their willingness to debate, not somebody's willingness to cover their debate.
And that's the issue of the follow-up question. In a town hall format, everybody has written their question. They're sitting in the audience, and through some vetting process, they get to ask it. And come hell or high water, when they are pointed to, that's the question they're going to ask. Even if the last words out of the mouth of one of the candidates is a bald-faced lie and a stunning news development, what have you. Without the opportunity for follow-up, won't these things just turn out to be 90-minute commercials for the candidates?
I would actually think that the most encouraging idea would be that the candidates provide that sort of check on one another. If Barack Obama, who's pretty well steeped in things relating to John McCain, hears John McCain make a bald-faced lie, presumably he would say that. McCain's famous sort of 100 years in Iraq comment, that's from a town hall in New Hampshire. It was some guy in the back. I was there. I was a few seats away. And the guy went after McCain four times. He kept coming back. And McCain let him, I mean, to his credit. And so I would suggest, A, that the media hasn't done a great job of doing follow-ups so far. And I would suggest, B, that there's no real reason to think they're the only ones who can.
You know, what's a little ironic about this, Ezra, is that both of these guys have had their career substantially propelled on the fairly fawning treatment that they've had from the national press. When it comes to dissing the media, you know, if it had been a Clinton-Romney campaign, this would have, you know, made perfect sense. It's a little surprising that this emanates from McCain and Obama.
I guess it could be, although I think that, you know, they're not taking an aggressive stance against the media. They're just saying this will be an open debate. Anyone can cover it. It'll be on the internet, and it's not going to be moderated by somebody who's trying to get content for their network. It's, oddly enough, a very mild thing they're saying. I mean, and imagine, the media has a real role here. They can hold the debate, and then right after, they could have their best people on the TV fact-checking, saying who was more truthful and who wasn't. I don't see this as an aggressive challenge against the media. I see this as a sort of more natural allocation of roles, and the media's incentives are not necessarily right for running a debate. But they are right for adjudicating one after it happens. And it would be a good thing if the media, rather than trying to gin up controversy in the question and answer period, attempted to try to settle disputes in the cool air of the aftermath.
So you don't even think of this as a reaction to the last straw of Charlie Gibson and George Stephanopoulos' performance in the penultimate Democratic debate.
No, I mean, I think that the problem for the media is that they have performed so poorly that the candidates can do this. Nobody's going to run in and demand their inclusion. The voters don't think they've been doing a great job. Insofar as Stephanopoulos and Gibson have a role here, it's been in making it possible for the candidates to probably do, you know, in some ways what they've always wanted to do, which is get out from under their thumb. And I really hope that this does force the media to reevaluate what would add value, what would make it so people wanted us involved. If you want to focus on trivia, you can. But if you do, don't be surprised when people turn on you. If you're out for yourself in this process, the voters aren't going to try and save you. The candidates aren't going to try and save you. And when you lose your leverage, you lose it.
Ezra, thank you.
Thank you.
Ezra Klein is an associate editor and a blogger for the American Prospect.
TV didn't enter the candidate debate business until the famous, for Richard Nixon, devastating debates between Nixon and John F. Kennedy in 1960. But that historic encounter did not inspire more such matchups. The networks that had jointly sponsored the debates were discouraged by the process, whereby the rules were hashed out by the campaigns and then imposed on their TV hosts. Nor were the candidates particularly eager for their close-ups. Alan Schroeder is the author of Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV. He says it took presidential contenders four full election cycles to get back on the small screen.
If you think about the history here, in 1964, it's interesting, before he was assassinated, JFK had pledged to debate again, and he and Barry Goldwater had agreed, in fact, to do the very thing that McCain's proposing, which is a series of town hall debates around the country. But Lyndon Johnson was the candidate in 1964. He basically didn't want to do it. He was far enough ahead that he didn't have to. In 1968, you had Richard Nixon, as well as in 1972, and Nixon had been so badly burned in the 1960 debates that he simply chose not to take part. And it wasn't until 1976, when you had President Gerald Ford, the incumbent, trailing his opponent, Jimmy Carter, that Ford issued a challenge at that year's Republican convention for there to be a resumption of presidential debates.
Looking at this historically, obviously, town hall debates are a time-honored format for political discussion, but they used to be real. You know, people would come and ask questions and they wouldn't be filtered. When they propose a town hall debate, is that what they really mean?
Well, that's part of the problem here, is there's ambiguity in that term, town hall debate. The very first town hall debate at the presidential debate level was in 1992, and it featured Clinton, the first George Bush, and Ross Perot. The moderator for that debate was Carol Simpson of ABC, and she had pretty much a free rein to call on any member of the audience that she wanted to, and they had free rein to ask any question that they wanted to. But as the years have gone on, the campaigns have built in additional protections over the years. For instance, in the last few cycles, the town hall questions had to be written down and submitted in advance. in the 2004 debates between John Kerry and George W. Bush, Bush's people insisted that if someone in the audience asking a question diverged from what had been written down in advance, that the microphone would have to be cut.
Wow.
So over the years, the campaigns have built in additional security measures for themselves that stand in the way of an open dialogue.
So if the candidates don't trust the network news anchors, doesn't sound like they really trust the ordinary citizen either.
In fact, I think if anything, the ordinary citizen is much more of a wild card than the journalist. You know, there's a great deal of preparation and rehearsal that goes into presidential debates. And if it's a journalist asking the questions, they can almost always identify in advance exactly what the topics will be. But when you've got an audience of several hundred people who are coming from God knows where, asking God knows what, there's no way you can game that in advance. And so you get asked some very strange things. This year on the campaign trail at one John McCain event, for instance, John McCain was asked by someone in the audience about an ugly name that he had allegedly called his wife in public.
Yes, she was making a joke about his thinning hair.
Yes.
And he used a four-letter word in reference to her that begins with C.
That's exactly right. And someone in a town hall audience stood up and asked him about that.
Is it true that you called your wife?
You know, it's a great thing about town hall meetings, sir, but we really don't. There's people here who don't respect that kind of language, so I'll see the next questioner in the back. Yes, sir, I see you.
In spite of all the restrictions, all the layers of security that are built in, you get these moments that reveal something about the candidate may not want us to see.
Alan, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Alan Schroeder teaches in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University and is the author of Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV.
Coming up, maybe businessmen aren't the best men for the news business.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. If the newspaper industry is currently under assault, and by just about every measure it is, no major paper has been under siege longer than the Los Angeles Times. A succession of top editors has come and gone in the last few years, all citing a frustration with management over layoffs and other budget cuts. But the cuts keep coming, and nobody can predict where this will all lead or when it might end. New York Times media reporter Richard Perez Pena has been covering this historic retrenchment. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Nobody is immune to this crisis in newspaper publishing. Your paper itself just went through a round of layoffs. But let's talk about the current brouhaha over the LA Times magazine, once a weekly, now a monthly, but also now something else altogether. What has happened?
Well, I think what people need to understand is that the tradition in American newspapers is that the advertising side of the operation and the newsroom side are entirely separate. The LA Times magazine is going to move from the control of the newsroom, which is where most newspaper magazines are, to the control of the business side. Now, what that'll actually mean for its operations and its content, we don't know. But people who are used to that tradition of true separation between the newsroom and the business side are made uneasy by it. Hmm.
Sam Zell, who controls the Tribune Company, himself has made it quite clear that he has a less than traditional view of how to run a newspaper property. Can you tell me about some of the things that he has said and done?
Well, most recently what he said is that all of the newspapers in Tribune Company have to become spicier, flashier, easier to read, more local in focus, more graphics, more charts and statistics, that sort of thing. You know, that's not a new idea. USA Today sort of pioneered that on a national scale 25 years ago, and a lot of people have copied it. It's a new idea for a paper like the Los Angeles Times, which always thought of itself as this very sober and serious newspaper that covered the nation and the world. But beyond that, what Zell has done over the last 6 months or so is really to attempt to shake people up, to give them a sense of urgency, and inevitably saying pretty outrageous things.
He made a remark to the Washington Bureau of the Times shortly after he took over that just freaked everybody out.
As it was repeated to me, the comment was, we have 45 people in Washington, D.C., and 6 in Orange County, and it ought to be the other way around. I mean, it's essentially saying to a group of your most prestigious people that many of their jobs shouldn't exist.
However one might feel about Sam Zell and his foul mouth and his, let's say, lack of diplomacy among his own staff, clearly the business he owns and the industry he's in now are in extremis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe in this new world, the idea that he has floated of half ads, half editorial content is simply a reality that we're all going to have to live with.
Tribune Company had just under $1 billion in operating profit last year, but not much in the way of income. And the reason is they had $12.8 billion in debt that they're carrying. So they have to spend almost $1 billion a year just to keep up that debt. So this is a group of newspapers that in and of themselves are making money, but they're being asked not only to cover the cost of operations, deliver profit for the corporation, but also to carry the cost of this enormous debt. Well, why do they have the enormous debt? Because back in 2000, Tribune Company bought Times Mirror, and then in 2007, Sam Zell took Tribune Company private. These were deals done with borrowed money. They didn't build any presses. They didn't buy any computer systems. They didn't build new buildings. They didn't add staff. This was money that added no value to the company. It just saddled it with enormous debt.
I want to go from the LA Times to another newspaper that's undergoing some wrenching times, and that's the Washington Post, which just bought out more than 100 editorial employees, mainly its most senior editorial employees, in order to deal with its ever-reducing profits.
Well, the scale of the reduction at the Post is not the same. At its peak several years ago, the Post had a newsroom staff something over 900 people. The Los Angeles Times had, I think, close to 1,200. These days, they're both somewhere in the neighborhood of 700. But in addition, the Washington Post has had management for decades, going back to three generations of the Graham family, that in every action they took gave the impression that they understood what journalism is supposed to be about, that the quality of the product mattered to them a great deal. And they, like the Chandler family at the LA Times, invested in really high-quality journalism. The Grahams are still in charge at the Washington Post Company. The Chandlers are long gone from the Los Angeles Times. And the new ownership of Tribune, which took hold just in December under Sam Zell, these are people who have no background in journalism. So people are asking whether they understand what the values and the ethics are supposed to be. Michael Kinsley wrote a hilarious column in Slate the other day that said, well, the Tribune wants to make an equal amount of space for the ads and the content. If you go to zero on both and stop publishing a newspaper, then that's equal, and you don't even have to pay the reporters.
Yeah, the problem isn't editorial ratio. It's the lack of advertising to begin with.
Exactly. The fundamental problem that the business faces is the decline in advertising revenue. Everything else that the business is experiencing pales in comparison to that. A lot of the Tribune Company employees I talk to say, we hear a plan for trimming the newsroom. We hear a plan for trimming the number of pages. We hear a plan for cutting costs. We don't hear a plan for increasing ad revenue.
Do you see any good news out there?
Well, to quote Dwight Eisenhower about Richard Nixon, if you gave me enough time, I might be able to come up with some.
All right, Richard, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Richard Perez Pena is a media reporter for the New York Times.
Frank Scandale is the editor of The Record of Bergen County, New Jersey. In a recent column, he noted that some readers were bothered by what they perceived as the paper's liberal bias. Now, editorial pages are supposed to have a slant, and in the case of The Record, it leans to the left. So a while back, some conservative voices were added to the op-ed page to provide a wider variety of views. But the news pages aren't supposed to be opinionated. So Scandale announced that he would conduct a six-month investigation investigation to see if, in fact, his paper is biased. He says that some biases may seem political when actually they're about something else. For instance, when Laura Bush and Jenna came to town on a book tour, the paper ran two pictures. Neither was of the long line of people waiting to see them. One was a shot of the First Lady and her daughter, but the larger picture depicted three lonely protesters with signs.
One of our missions here is to put harder news in the newspaper, and that includes photographs. And the picture that was presented in the photo show at which I attended was a very soft picture of Laura and Jenna Bush waving with the book. Then they presented this other picture of the protesters. And I said, well, that's something you don't see every day in Glen Rock, New Jersey. So as a group, we said, well, let's put those pictures in. Now, I truly don't remember who said it was a two-column and who said it was a three-column, meaning the size of the picture and how that worked. But the perception is that we were trying to put down the Bushes, and that was the bias, when the mission of the conversation was, we need harder news in the paper.
Yeah, well, there is hard news bias, which does create distortions. It's been chronicled in lots of papers all over the place. And also, perhaps in this case, your bias towards putting a photo on the cover when neither of them, one was too soft and the other was unrepresentative. You had no good choices there. Maybe you shouldn't have put in a picture at all.
And then people would say, why don't you put the picture of the Bushes? Because you don't like George Bush. I don't doubt that there is some bias coming out in the pages. Now, on the other hand, I think people can bring bias from their point of view. They read our stuff, and if it doesn't match up with their perception, then we're biased. One of the recent charges of bias came when Obama went over the top with the delegates. Now, that came late in the day, and Hillary had not pulled out, so there was some ambivalence. But by and large, the papers in this area wrote big stories above the fold. We're a very local paper. We've really sharpened our focus to be North Jersey-centric.
That's your unique selling proposition.
That's our strategy, correct. That said, we focused on the Senate race here, the primary, Frank Lautenberg and Zimmer, and that's what our plan was to go along. Now, the Obama thing, we weren't even discussing it at our 3:30 meeting. And this, of course, happens later. The news editors on duty debate, and they say, no, our mission is still local, so we'll put the Obama thing on the bottom.
Below the fold on the front page.
Correct.
And people were accusing you of racism?
Racism or anti-Obama or something. One of the conversations I had with a fellow who called in, representing a couple of African-American groups, I said, if I was a racist, then why did we endorse Obama in the primary, one of the very few papers who did? And he paused and he said, okay, that's a good point. However, but the good news about all these letters and emails that I'm getting is that people are passionate. They are engaged with a newspaper. And they are just about every single one of these letters starts out with, you know, kudos to the Record, kudos to you for putting yourself out there, kudos for anybody that would even look at this as a possibility.
So kudos to you for putting it out there, and now let us explain why you are irreparably screwed up. You know, it's been argued that the values of journalism naturally line up with the values of liberalism in that journalists question authority, at least they're supposed to do that when they're doing their job, that they challenge institutions, that they dig deep into places where they're not supposed to go, that this is sort of part and parcel of the craft.
I totally agree. Two points to make is I've written a column basically espousing what you just said, that we tend to be those kinds of people. I have a letter here from a fellow who said he used to be a newspaper reporter, editor, and columnist, and he said, yep, you guys have a liberal paper, albeit one I have never read. How can I know this? Well, and I say this was tongue-in-cheek, it would never occur to a conservative paper to engage in such introspection. I mean, he's
clearly a liberal. You're at the very beginning of a six-month process. Once you get a final verdict, how do you intend to respond to it?
If we find examples in our news pages that we have exhibited a sincere bias in a way that is truly against what news should be, and it is definitely costing us readers, then as a newspaper, the right thing to do would be certainly address it, make adjustments, and make sure that we're not presenting the news unfairly or unbalanced.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Frank Scandale is the editor of The Record of Bergen County, New Jersey.
J. Jane Novak, New Jersey's stay-at-home mom, is an enemy of the state. The particular state is Yemen, where Novak's blog, Armies of Liberation, is considered by the government to be seditious propaganda, but by many Yemenis as a voice of freedom, transparency, and human rights. By stumbling upon the struggles of a persecuted journalist and championing his case, one housewife has bedeviled and shamed the oppressive regime. Novak's story is something like Aaron Brockovich meets Lawrence of Arabia, a saga that began in the wake of September 11th, when Novak, who had never written an article and knew next to nothing about the Middle East, wanted to do something.
I wanted to talk to the people there just as a normal American, as one parent to another, to at least start some kind of conversation.
Now, your blog took a kind of change in character a couple of years ago when you got on the case of a Yemeni journalist named Abdulkaram El-Khouani. First of all, how did you find out about him? And then tell me a little bit about his story.
I found out about him when I was reading the Yemeni newspapers, and I discovered that he had been arrested and imprisoned for his writings.
The stories that upset the Yemeni government concerned the government's fight with rebels in the north of the country. Al-Khouani went to the north, discovered mass graves, and reported on them, and for that he has been persecuted, certainly prosecuted by the government. You started writing about him, and some extraordinary things began to happen.
Well, I began to write about his case, and then I began to do some research onto Yemen, and I discovered that it was entirely different than I had thought it was and that it seemed to be. There is a four-year war going on in northern Yemen where the government is engaged in indiscriminate bombing, and there's a lot of civilian casualties, and there's a blockade on food. And it's a near genocide, and in a way it's very similar to the situation in Sudan. Furthermore, the government is entirely corrupt. So when I started writing about that, it apparently crossed all the red lines in Yemen, because these articles were also published in Yemen in Arabic. And the Yemeni people were very happy to read them, but the Yemeni government was not.
Now, this was a capital case. He had written that he fully expected to be executed on charges of sedition. In fact, the sentence came in a few days ago, 6 years in prison. Then what happened?
What happened was the actual charge he was convicted on was undermining the morale of the military with a published article, and for that he received a six-year sentence. Journalist organizations around the world and the U.S. State Department immediately issued statements calling for this sentence to be overturned.
What further influence do you suspect that you may have?
Well, the influence that I've had on Al-Khouani's case is to entirely dispel the propaganda that he's a terrorist. They thought that by standing him next to some rebels that the world would buy that crazy concept, but everyone knows that he's not. He's a journalist. And to some degree, I think my efforts give the Yemeni people themselves a lot of hope, because they feel that someone can see them and someone is telling their story. People ask me, why did you pick Yemen? And the answer really is, Yemen picked me. When everyone started writing me hundreds of letters thanking me for being honest and saying the truth. So I just couldn't turn away from that.
Now, you have never met Abdulkaram Al-Khouani, but you have been in contact. When did you last communicate?
I received a letter from him the day before he was going to be sentenced. And he said, don't think I'm saying goodbye. Maybe I'll talk to you tomorrow. But it was a very hard letter to read, because he knew he was going to jail. And he said, at least if I'm going in, the world is going to know that I'm not a terrorist, I'm an innocent journalist, and thank you for that. But I haven't actually been able to read the letter. I just skimmed it, burst into tears, and got back to work.
A slight detour. I have to ask about your husband and your kids. Do you ever hear something like, Mom, enough with Yemen, I want some more, fill in the blank?
Sometimes, But my kids are very proud of me, and my husband as well, because I read them letters from the Yemenis, and they're very heart-rending statements of gratitude. This story shows what a person with civil rights and an internet connection can do, because all I'm doing is writing, talking, researching, and I'm trying to put out correct information about Yemen, and I've received thousands of letters thanking me for my efforts and asking me not to stop. And what's happening here is that the internet helped me punch a wall through the iron curtain that the Yemeni government tries to put up between its people and the rest of the world. And my husband in particular is entirely supportive of me. He understands that when there's like a riot in Yemen or Al-Hawani goes to jail, he may be eating pizza for 2 days, and he never gives me a hard time, and I couldn't never have done this without his strength backing me up.
All right, Jane. Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Jane Novak is a housewife and blogger at armiesofliberation.com.
Coming up, treating PTSD with virtual reality and what happens when Hollywood puts science in the picture.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A recent RAND study concluded that 300,000 U.S. military personnel have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression. PTSD is the focus of a recent lawsuit in which two veterans groups are suing the Veterans Administration for not adequately providing health care to vets. Last week, a federal judge reopened the case to consider new evidence suggesting that VA counselors had been discouraged from making PTSD diagnoses because it can be a long and costly process. And while it's hard to diagnose, it's even harder to cure. Psychology researcher Dr. Albert Skip Rizzo says he has a new tool for combating PTSD, a virtual reality simulator based on the video game Full Spectrum Warrior. With an adapted version of the video game, a virtual reality headset, a vibrating seat, and various smells, Rizzo has created a program he calls Virtual Iraq, where soldiers can confront their traumatic experiences. Of the 15 soldiers who have gone through the full treatment, 12 no longer meet the criteria for PTSD. All that from a video game?
While we did start off with the basis of a computer game, it's not really a game anymore. It's a tool that allows a clinician to put somebody back in an environment, in an immersive environment, but in a very controlled fashion. Whereas in a game, you're in the game and you're shooting at things and you may get shot at and all that. None of that happens in this system. In fact, we specifically don't have it so that you can shoot a weapon in this environment.
Why not?
Well, we feel that that is at odds with the whole premise. We're not trying to foster some kind of a cathartic revenge fantasy that doesn't prepare someone for civilian life. The goal is for the person to revisit what they've experienced, but in a very graduated fashion, a very safe manner, and in a supportive fashion where they can begin to start to talk about what they went through.
Before we talk about virtual Iraq, can you tell us about other psychological conditions for which using a safe virtual environment is therapeutic?
I think virtual reality really got its start in the area of clinical application with the treatment of simple phobias, people that have fear of heights, fear of flying, fear of spiders. And by putting a person in an environment, say being in a virtual airplane, could be gradually introduced. It works better than doing it in imagination, and it's as good as doing it in the real world.
Just as good as the real world?
what you find is that humans have a tremendous capacity to suspend disbelief. So you do see, even in a very primitive virtual environment, say a glass elevator for fear of heights, and they know they're not in a real elevator, but they get sweaty palms as you go up, their heart rate goes up, and they react to it as if it's the real environment. But you're in the clinician's office.
So you can simulate an elevator, but how do you simulate war?
What we've done to develop virtual Iraq, first off, is had soldiers in Iraq actually try out virtual Iraq and tell us what we got right and wrong. And armed with that feedback, we went back to the drawing boards where we're continually evolving the application. We looked at what are some of the standard environments, and we isolated being on a desert road in a Humvee and also going on a foot patrol through an Iraqi-type city. Within any of those environments, the clinician has a separate control panel where they can adjust the settings in a fashion that matches what the patient has already reported to the therapist and add in elements that make it more provocative.
So walk us through it, and we will insert some of the audio that you sent us before this interview.
Okay, so you may start off in the Humvee by the side of the road without any sound except the sound of wind. Then, as the patient begins to adjust to that, we can add in perhaps the sound of the Humvee motor and the vibration from the platform that they're sitting on, so you actually feel the motor. We invite them to pull out onto the roadway and start driving. The next step would be to add some provocative elements, maybe gunfire in the distance, maybe an American weapon, an M4 sound. We can add in the sound of a helicopter flying over, an A-10 flying over the scene. And as you progress through the therapy, you can add in an IED going off.
So you have a pretty complex web of sounds. Describe what they're seeing through their virtual reality visor.
The neat thing with the virtual reality headset is that it's got a head tracker built into it so that as you turn your head, the graphics update and you get the illusion of being in the environment. And as you're driving in the Humvee, you can look to the right of you and see a passenger, a fella in the turret up above you. And you can also eliminate those folks if those aren't relevant to the patient's story.
But if they are relevant, if part of their trauma involves the death of a buddy, say, you'll have someone representing that buddy, perhaps in that position when the accident occurs?
Yes.
Will the soldier that you're treating see that death reenacted?
Now, if the clinician feels that the patient is prepared for it, that virtual passenger can, in fact, sustain a wound, a mild wound or a more significant wound, and slump over in the vehicle. Now, a lot of times that might not even be necessary. We're very careful not to do this in a fashion that might push someone over the edge, but rather to do it in an alliance with the therapist and the patient together, deciding what will come next.
What sense triggers the most intense reactions? We've heard some of the sounds. You've described some of the visuals. I was intrigued to learn you also use smells.
Some people are going to react more to one type of stimuli than another. What I could say generally is that I think the visuals sort of set the stage. It puts a person back in a place. But what really drives the emotion, number one, is the sound. Some of the sounds, like when you walk through the city, you hear an ambient soundtrack of city sounds and you hear a baby crying in the distance. Very evocative. We know from theory that the sense of smell directly connects to the brain in the area that's responsible for memory and emotion.
What are some of the smells you use in the program?
Burning rubber, diesel fuel, gunpowder, rotting garbage, body odor, Iraqi spice. We're looking to get the smell of cooked lamb because that is something that soldiers report. Smell of burnt hair is also one that's on order. That's one I think has relevance because the smell of burnt hair is something that you would get in a civilian environment, walking by a hair salon. You might get a whiff of that, and that could bring you right back.
Do you think this treatment does something dramatically different, or is it just a way to get people who are otherwise opposed to therapy in the door, like slipping crushed up medicine into a kid's ice cream.
There's so much stigma associated with the diagnosis of PTSD that a lot of soldiers are hesitant to seek treatment. And some soldiers are just not of the type where the traditional talk therapy is something that they're attracted to. I've even proposed changing the name from therapy to post-combat reintegration training. And by having the VR as a tool, it sort of takes the heat off of the interpersonal nature, even though that does occur in the therapy naturally.
You mentioned that virtual reality has been used to treat other things, phobias like, you know, spiders or flying. I just wonder whether this technology could be applied to patients who suffer from PTSD based on experiences that can't be so easily simulated in a video game.
The key is to use good clinical judgment in determining when it's useful and when it's a good tool, and not just think you're going to throw technology at every clinical problem and it's going to fix itself. I don't propose that VR is the panacea for all forms of PTSD. I certainly would not advocate that you create a sexual assault virtual reality environment. But for the areas where VR is well matched to the clinical condition, I think we can do things better.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Psychology researcher Dr. Albert Rizzo. Before virtual reality, we had Hollywood, which often uses the raw material of real life to make money and sometimes art. Since the medium began, movies from Metropolis to Iron Man have plundered science, molding and sometimes mangling it. But physicist Sidney Perkowitz argues in his new book, Hollywood Science, Movies, Science, and the End of the World, that science in cinema probably does more good than harm.
One reason which needs to be recognized more is what big influence they had on turning young people in the direction of science. The second thing, just speaking as an educator, is even if the science isn't right, you can use it to teach correct science to people who want to learn. Third reason is that they often raised issues about how science and society interact. A lot of the movies of the 1950s had fear of nuclear war as a theme.
Klaatu barada nikto.
You got it, and that was an important message. For those who don't know, that comes from the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, in which an alien comes to Earth to warn us to stop fooling around with nuclear explosions.
I am leaving soon, and you will forgive me if I speak bluntly. The universe grows smaller every day, and the threat of aggression by any group, anywhere, can no longer be tolerated. It is no concern of ours how you run your own planet. But if you threaten to extend your violence, this Earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder.
Now, you liked The Day After Tomorrow, a global warming film released in 2004. There were storms, a tsunami, an ice age, you name it. It was criticized as bad science at the time.
There's no question the science was terribly exaggerated. The film had all these bad effects that you just mentioned happening over a period of weeks, whereas everything we know about global warming says we're talking about a timescale of decades. But it alerted the public to a real issue. We could compare it to Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, which did get the science just about 100% perfect. But The Day After Tomorrow, judging by ticket sales, reached about 10 times as many people. So it has an impact, like it or not, distorted science or not, it has its effect.
And you're saying that's always a good thing?
Couldn't guarantee it's always a good thing. The science could be so distorted that it would be worthless. But if more people know about the possibility of global warming than did 5 years ago, I think that's a good thing.
That theme has been explored at least as far back as 1973's Soylent Green, where we're already far after the disaster.
It showed what the world would be like had things gone to pot in the way we're envisioning might be happening right now.
They're making our food out of people. Next thing, they'll be breeding us like cattle for food. You gotta tell them. You gotta tell them. You tell everybody. You gotta tell them. Silent Green is people!
What did you mean when you wrote that there is active feedback between movie science and real science?
The most famous example of active feedback is the fact that when we launch a rocket, we count down from 10 to 1. That actually came out in an early German science fiction movie from the 1920s, and apparently NASA loved the idea and has used it ever since. They get inspiration from the B-movies even when the science isn't right. And, of course, the science feeds into the movies. The fact that there are movies about genetic engineering when it has barely started proves that point. The movies pick up what's at the front of the wave very quickly.
Let's talk about genetic engineering. We had Gattaca, where people are genetically engineered to be more or less perfect, and one who was born naturally has to fake his way through using other people's urine and so forth so that he can travel in space, which is all he ever really wanted.
There is no gene for fate. And when, for one reason or another, a member of the elite falls on hard times, their genetic identity becomes a valued commodity for the unscrupulous. One man's loss is another man's gain.
I put that movie on my list of 10 best because I thought it had such a well-done human element. So the science was there, but the movie is really more about the impact of science on people. I think that's an important thing to convey.
You also look at how scientists are portrayed in movies, and you say that they come in three flavors, essentially: evil, noble, or nerdy. Give me some examples of each variety.
There was a character named Rudvang in a film from the 1920s, Metropolis. Rudvang thinks he can replace his real-life girlfriend, who he's lost, with a robot. A noble scientist would be Dennis Quaid in The Day After Tomorrow. He risks his career, his profession, his family to try to convince the government that global warming really is coming. And a nerdy, well, there are more examples than you can think of.
Do you think that movies that actually use scientists as consultants are more accurate than movies that don't?
They should be. In real life, they're often not. Sometimes they're hired very late in the production process. So if the scientist says, you know, really, there is no air on the moon and you need to change that, it's too late to change it because it'll cost tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. So there's no guarantee. But the movie Contact, on my list of 10 best, actually had a lot of scientific consultants into science, and that movie rings pretty true.
Let's talk about that film briefly. It starred Jodie Foster as a scientist who was neither evil, nerdy, nor noble. She was just devoted.
Yeah, there are 400 billion stars out there just in our galaxy alone. If only one out of a million of those had planets, all right, and if just one out of a million of those had life, and if just one out of a million of those had intelligent life, there would be literally millions of civilizations out there.
One of the best representations of a film scientist there is, and Jodie Foster's part, in the fact that she's a woman, an underrepresented category, makes it even better.
Have you seen Iron Man yet?
Not yet, but I sure have read a lot about it.
It's a film where a genius scientist basically makes weapons that kill people, and then he makes another weapon, only this one he uses to protect innocent people from being killed by his bad weapons.
I might say, as far as the technology goes, of the Iron Man suit, there's no doubt that this kind of thing can happen. The U.S. military and other agencies have already taken steps in that direction.
Like what?
Powered exoskeletons, a steel framework you put around yourself that's powered by motors and gives you more endurance or greater speed or greater strength.
In the end, would you say that Hollywood has been good for science?
Maybe by 51% to 49%. I'm not sure I would make it more than that, but I think we should all try and get the best we can out of the way Hollywood does treat science in the movies. If we're smart, we can use Hollywood to do good things for science.
All right. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. It was really fun.
Dr. Sidney Perkowitz is a professor of physics at Emory University and the author of Hollywood Science, Movie Science, and the End of the World.
Everybody has hopes and dreams and aspirations about how we see our country and how we see our world. And I do think that John McCain and Barack Obama are really going to paint very different pictures. And we saw the beginning of that tonight. And it's going to be really extraordinary for us as a country, as a people, to have this chance to listen to this. And if we can have an election with huge differences on big issues, it will be so important for our country and for our democracy, and it could really add even more to this already historic election.
NBC's Tim Russert on the night Barack Obama claimed the Democratic presidential nomination. Russert will not witness this extraordinary moment in political history. The affable interviewer and pundit who became NBC's top political journalist by asking tough questions with an easy smile died Friday of a heart attack. He was 58 years old. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Nadia Zonis, Gina Gasper, Addie Rolnick, and Hannah Needleman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.